Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, games, film, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And a few housekeeping notes before we get started with our monster of the day. My newest book, and it's actually a debut collection of short stories. I've put out a novel before, but not a book of short stories. Well, it's now available for pre-order if you're listening to this before the publication date, the official one of March 15th. If you're listening to this after March 15th, 2019, then it's available right now. So check out the publisher's website, press53.com. Check out their bookstore and their short fiction collection. You're going to see my book, Oh Monstrous World. It's a collection of stories I've written over the years. And you can also find that link on my website, joshwoodsauthor.com. You can even pre-order it on amazon.com. Just search amazon.com for Oh Monstrous World or check out my author's page. You can find it there. I think it's a really fun book. And if you like the kinds of things that we talk about on this podcast, then some of these stories, I think all of the stories will be up your alley. So check that out. I appreciate it. So for today, I want to talk about invisible monsters. So by invisible monsters, I'm thinking of a category of a type of monster. I'm not making any reference to the book by Chuck Palahniuk, Invisible Monsters, by the way, or at least I don't mean to, but I'm making that reference now. That's a good book. As I recall, that was his first one, and no publisher or agent wanted anything to do with it, and he was so like resentful and furious that he decided to write something just antisocial and something that was going to make everybody mad. So he wrote Fight Club in response. And of course, that was the one that everybody loved. And that put him on the map and made him rich and famous and everything. But Invisible Monsters was later published because they wanted anything they could get their hands on that had his name on it. But you read that one, and that one has a lot more of that like raw energy that first books so often have, rough around the edges, but really cool. I remember them talking about making a movie of this thing, and it would be darn near unfilmable. I mean, the main character would be this supermodel who's like missing a jaw, and her tongue is just hanging there. Like, I think John Waters maybe could have made the film for this thing back in 1977, but I don't know if anyone can make it now. Anyway, it's worth checking out, but not the kind of monsters we want to talk about today. I want to talk about monsters that you literally cannot see. So many cool ones to talk about. Maybe we should go a little bit chronologically. I think the first real, like, invisible killer, invisible monster, was the story of Gyges and the Ring of Gyges. I think probably the most famous version of that is the one that shows up in Plato, I think in his Republic, if I'm remembering correctly. In which Socrates and some of the other characters are talking about, like, what makes social norms or right and wrong in a society, what makes them hold. And so they started playing with this story of this guy who comes across this cave that was recently reopened by an earthquake, and he goes down in there and he finds this ring or in some stories this pair of rings, but you put on the ring and you turn it a certain way and you turn invisible. You can turn it another way and you turn back to visible. And so the first thing Gyges does with this ring is decide to go straight for the king to seduce his wife, although it's not clear how the invisible part helped that. And then he, of course, murders the king and then takes the throne himself. And so very quickly he uses his powers for invisibility for evil and power gain. The point they were arguing is whether or not if anything you did couldn't be seen or known by other people and you had free rein to commit any kind of crime or see through any sort of dark fantasy that you wanted to, and invisibility was like their storytelling image of that. If you had that freedom, what would you do? And one of the characters was arguing to Socrates that human nature is to turn into this kind of invisible monster the moment you have the chance. Socrates argued with him that, if I'm remembering correctly, it's been a long time, but if I'm remembering correctly, something to the effect of no, your crimes are kind of at that point overtaking you, that changes who you are, and you kind of lose out to this other different creature. Whether you do it visible or not, it has the same kind of negative effect. You don't get a pass just because no one saw you do the thing, because you saw yourself do the thing no matter what. So those of you who are familiar with the works of J.R.R. Tolkien and are maybe hearing the Ring of Gyges story for the first time from ancient Greece are thinking, wait a minute, a magic ring that turns you invisible and that tempts you into evil and power grabbing, isn't that kind of like something I might have heard about in Lord of the Rings? Yes, I think very much so. And there's a lot I want to talk about in regards to that, but I am currently teaching a Tolkien literature class, and I save up a whole lot of my best Tolkien stuff for that, because otherwise, if I got talking too much about Lord of the Rings, Silmarillion, the various works of Tolkien, then this podcast would very quickly just turn into another Tolkien podcast, and you already have a great one out there. Corey Olson's Tolkien Professor classes or recorded lectures, there's no beating those for podcast quality, so I'll let him have that realm. Every now and then I'll focus on, I think we'll spend some time on some Tolkien monsters, but I want to save up. So with that mention, I'm probably going to avoid a little bit talking about the Nazgul or Gollum or the rings as invisible monsters and maybe focus on a few other ones. So if we're going chronologically, although there are, I believe, some, especially if you're bringing in ghosts and stuff, although there are other monsters that have been like invisible between the time of the ancient Greek stories and now, the main one that starts us off with the kind of modern tradition of the invisible monsters, I think, is in 1893, Ambrose Bierce published a story called The Damned Thing. Ambrose Bierce, you might be familiar with his story, The Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which is an excellent story. In fact, in any sort of like writing class scenario, students or young writers who are exploring different story ideas for the first time very often come across this moment where they feel like they've invented this story idea in which the whole story was just a dream. Can you imagine? Now, if you've never run across that story before, maybe you do think it's kind of cool and edgy and new. Those of you who have been around stories for a long time and know that it was all just a dream is one of the most tired tropes that you could come across. However, that's not to say that it can't be done really well. And the person who kind of was the pioneer of doing it really well was Ambrose Bierce occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, I think. He also wrote The Devil's Dictionary, which is just endlessly funny. If you just scroll through there at any time, it's set up as a dictionary, but all the definitions are of this kind of modern cynicism. I think really we could just replace all of our current dictionaries with just this one, and it would make perfect sense to everybody. Just ever so briefly, like, you know, you scroll to just, or you flip to just W, and you look up some of his definitions there. War, the first sentence in his definition of war is a byproduct of the arts of peace. And then, or maybe one that's relevant to this show, Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary definition of werewolf. He says, a wolf that was once or is sometimes a man. All werewolves are of evil disposition, having assumed a bestial form to gratify a bestial appetite. But some, transformed by sorcery, are as humane as is consistent with an acquired taste for human flesh. It's so funny. He was ahead of his time on so many things. I brought him up on a previous podcast, I believe, the Robots and Golems podcast, in which he's one of the first writers to have kind of a robot rise up and kill its creator, master kind of thing. Well, in The Damned Thing, it's this kind of discussion, story, mystery about the strange death or murder, and this witness trying to convince others of what really happened saw that this man was attacked by some type of invisible beast out in the field. And this invisible thing, this damned thing, they only knew it was there. Well, the witness only knew it was there because he saw it like making impressions in the grass. Like the grass would be pushed down as he went along or walked or tromped along. He couldn't tell what was happening to the man when he was being attacked because it's like he would seem to fling himself around or twist his own arm up in some type of impossible way. But then the witness noticed that in a certain form, whatever he was seeing, the image and the light seemed to be distorted in a certain way, as if he were seeing through air that was being disturbed, or maybe light that was being bent in a type of prism. And so this thing wasn't entirely visible. It was somehow bending light around itself. And one of the final conclusions that this witness is making is that certain animals have evolved different types of camouflage. This is 1893, so well in the realm of Darwin's ideas about evolution being still very well known and very popular as well. And so you would get types of well, essentially this is science fiction, right? You would get various types of science fiction still kind of revved up from those ideas. And his thought was that maybe if certain beasts in the world can evolve to camouflage themselves in different surroundings just by looking like the surrounding or altering their pigment for a surrounding, why couldn't an animal alter itself in a way that, say, some minerals can do, which is to bend light around themselves? One of the main inspirations was not too long before the story came out, a lot of new findings on optics and lenses and bending light and properties of images that we see. And Ambrose Bierce was kind of revved up and inspired by that too. And so he gave us The Damned Thing. And so I would say, you know, it could fall under the category, what I meant by science fiction, it could fall under that category, because the fundamental feature that turns the story is some aspect of science that is draws from a fact of science that is the next step possibility that's still fiction right now, but theoretically could be based on science. I think that that would qualify essentially as hard science fiction, but also horror. And I think that the two kind of can cross paths or be one and the same for many different types of stories. We might even say this was an example of both science fiction and horror being one and the same. And a connection to the damn thing. You might think of this as like, isn't that a prequel to The Predator? Or wasn't that like the ancestor of the movie The Predator and the various Predator movies? Well, it sure seems like it. When you read this thing, it sounds, except for like his little laser beam shoulder cannon thing, the Predators, it reads in all other ways exactly as if the Predator was attacking people in 1893. So maybe the damn thing was one of the earlier Predator hunts. I don't know. Speaking of like prequels to the Predator, I wanted out of Predator 2 or maybe some other Predator was I wanted it to be set back in like the year 500. Or like 500. And I wanted the Predator to end up in at the Hall of Heorot and King Hrothgar. And I wanted him to start attacking their warriors in the hall at night. And then I wanted Beowulf to come over and hear about this monster and fight it. And so I wanted the Predator story to be the Beowulf story. And Grendel is the Predator. And so Beowulf is like fighting hand to hand with this Predator and ends up tearing off his arm that has this self-destruct nuclear device, so he can't just, you know, fall back on that plan, and that's what they hang up over the door, and he flees back to the mothership that has kind of been buried just like Grendel's mother's cave, you know, down under the falls and in the swamp. And so Beowulf goes out instead of going to fight Grendel's mother as his second monster, he gets down in Grendel's mother's cave. Instead, he gets down into the mothership of the Predator hunters, and then he encounters a female Predator, which would be like this massive monstrous thing that puts the male Predator hunters to shame. That would have been so cool. And so you'd have a whole Beowulf Predator right there. I think that would have been awesome. But, you know, since I probably will never get around to writing that screenplay. And let's say one reason is because even if I did, nothing would happen with it other than it's just being some type of weird fan fiction. And that would be about it. And so I pulled a Kilgore Trout, by the way. By that, I'm referring to Kurt Vonnegut. And one thing he would do is, in many of his different novels, he would slide in this character, a recurring character, Kilgore Trout, which sounds like a description of some version of himself. And he was like this pulp science fiction writer. And he would describe Kilgore Trout, some of Kilgore Trout's latest project ideas. And they almost all seemed like some of the stories that Kurt Vonnegut himself might have been interested in writing, but he was never going to get around to it. So he just wrote about somebody else writing about that thing so he could just get the idea out there and then be done with it. And so that's Kilgore Trouting an idea in my mind. And so I Kilgore Trouted Beowulf or Predator 2 as the Beowulf story in a story of mine called, it's in the collection, the debut collection, by the way, if I'm going to plug it one more time, Oh Monstrous World. In one of the stories, one of the characters starts talking, says, you know, what Predator should have been, and then he lays out that same idea that I just said. And so I kind of in a way put it out there, but without actually putting in the work. So it's one of the laziest ways to handle a story idea that you're excited about. So you might be wondering, okay, back to the invisible monster thing, the damned thing, 1893. I mean, wasn't H.G. Wells' Invisible Man before that? I think actually Invisible Man was a few years later. Not to say exactly that H.G. Wells was inspired directly by Ambrose Bierce's story, but I mean, 1897, I believe, is the date on Wells. So he was a handful of years behind. And I think in all likelihood, he was inspired by Ambrose Bierce, as so many were. The Invisible Man is a really cool book. God, it takes this idea of being physically invisible and just your natural, like, naked state. And that's it. Like, if you put on clothes, you're not invisible. But it takes that concept so far and so seriously. Essentially, what the guy would have to do to remain invisible is to run around naked all the time. And when you're running around naked in, like, a cold, damp environment, then you're probably going to get sick and miserable. And he ends up, I mean, very, very quickly, this character ends up being a vicious, killer, murderer kind of guy. And so he's a monster, and it's unclear, like, how long he's been evil or whether this invisibility has made him evil. And as eventually, the whole town or the whole village starts catching on that they've got this invisible monster on the loose. And so he's trying to continue to hide in complete invisibility, but he has a cold because he's naked everywhere he goes. And so he's trying to, like, not sneeze. He ends up hiding out in what is essentially a mall, like a late Victorian era mall, and, like, sleeping in the display beds and stuff, and trying not to sneeze to give himself away. Because if you hear something but you're not seeing anything, that means he's there. And so the whole town and various surrounding towns finally figure it out. Like, look, it's just a guy who's invisible, and all we have to do is to stop him is the same things we would do to stop a fugitive. So they cut off transportation, they block and guard the roads, they have scouts everywhere, and everybody in town is trying to hunt this guy down, and they start closing in the circle and closing it in on him, and he keeps trying to find ways to not get detected, but to slide through them, and it doesn't work, and he keeps having to retreat back to the center of the circle, and they don't know where exactly he is, but they know he's not outside of the circle they're making. And so chapter after chapter, they're getting closer and closer to him, until he finally is cornered against, kind of, as I remember envisioning it, kind of like a cliff wall, almost like this. And then the villagers are, like, surrounding him, and they finally figure out that he's somewhere in the space right in front of him. So they start, like, kicking and attacking and beating at the air, knowing that they're engaging with something and harming something, and they can hear his cries. And so the whole town essentially lynches him, this invisible form on the ground right in front of him. But as they do, the moment they finally kill him, he rematerializes, he becomes visible again, and that's when you get this surprise reaction out of everybody. They see him and they go, oh, he's disgusting. Like, they're all revolted and disgusted by him because he's an albino, and he's also just kind of naturally unattractive and ugly on top of his albinism. So it's not like one of these sexy, cool, kind of angelic looking albinism cases. He's just this weird, ugly albino guy. And they all, like, hate that. And then it becomes clear, they never really clarified why he went to these extreme measures to turn himself invisible, and why he got so resentful that he became like this murderous monster of a man who had really no moral checks on his behavior. No, he was no longer held back by anybody else's standards or anything. And so essentially kind of the Ring of Gyges storyline, but it never said what that backstory was or why. It never even says his name. I mean, even his name is invisible to us, which was, I think, a good move by H.G. Wells. And then once you see everyone's reaction to how he looked before he turned himself invisible, then it starts to become clear. Oh, he was, I mean, there were hints that he was treated poorly and he couldn't get the respect he deserved as a simple kind of chemist and student, but it never gets into detail on that. And then you can see, oh, everybody hated him because of the way he looked. And his whole life was ruined by this kind of weird, this weird bigotry that was essentially a type of racist bigotry, but also the more common kind of bigotry is that you're not as attractive as everybody wants you to be, so they treat you in this weird way. And so they kind of drove him to be a monster, and then they end up lynching him all the same anyway. And then what do you get? You get that final revelation at the end. And so I like to call that the horror reverse. It's one of the moves in a horror story or something that's essentially horror is that there's some element of inevitability or implication in that the characters involved in the story were destined to do this thing or be involved in this horrible thing, or the horror reverse is the implication, as in you are actually responsible for the monster and are a monster in your own way. As you go out hunting for monsters, you find that you were the monster you were hunting for. And so in stories, I think Invisible Man is one of those great horror reverses because it doesn't draw too much attention to itself at the end. But if you're close reading of it shows you how kind of shockingly powerful that is. I think in part because he leaves it so subtle at the end. It's a fantastic novel. So where should we go from there for Invisible Monsters? I mean, why not right back into Predator? Predator, the original 80s film is one of these weird films that shouldn't still hold up. It shouldn't still be as good as it is. But I remember at at one Halloween party at somebody else's place, it was actually a trailer that I at one point owned but I wasn't living in, and then somebody else kind of like broke in there and squatted in there, and I didn't know for months, and then he ended up buying it off of me because he liked it so much. I happened to know the person the whole time, and he thought for some reason that I knew that he was in. Anyway, this is way off track. It was at a Halloween party at the time where he owned this trailer, and on TV, just in the background, was Predator playing. I'm like, oh, that's Predator. But it's like, yeah, and we're just kind of moving through the room and doing other stuff. And then, like, person by person, minute by minute, we kind of start trickling back in front of the TV until we're all just kind of standing in front of it and watching these moments. Like, wait a minute, there is no reason why this movie from decades ago should still be compelling to a group of people who have a whole lot of other entertainment right in front of them. What, something about it is still really watchable, even though most of it is a whole bunch of like beefcakes with machine guns walking through the lawn and garden section of Lowe's, like pushing their way through plants and then just like really dramatic movement music while guys like push leaves out of the way. Like if you cut all those minutes out of Predator, the whole thing's like 15 minutes long. Why is it so good? I don't really know. I think part of it might be that, the story is kind of built on revelation, like finding out one extra new little bit of information that leads you toward another little bit of information, where you see highly capable people thrown in a circumstance that in which they no longer have the upper hand, and so they need to like figure out this mystery. There's something that's always going to be compelling about a story that has something intriguing that you find out about it just bit by bit, little by little. Even if you, as a viewer of it or a reader of it, already know the secret or the outcome or the whole backstory, it's still kind of interesting to watch the characters go through these moments of little revelation. I think that's always going to be compelling. Part of the reason why Predator holds up so well, I think. And maybe another reason it's so good is because for a lot of those monster films and those kinds of the horror films, it's so intriguing to have the monster, or at least the most interesting aspects of the monster, be unseen. Or unseen throughout so much of the film until maybe the very end, when you no longer need to keep hiding it for that kind of intrigue and tension. I'm thinking of Jaws, as in, like, everybody kind of acknowledges the fact that one of the most terrifying features of the original Jaws film is that you don't get to see Jaws until you finally do at the end, and then it's not quite as scary, which I think we mentioned before happened kind of by accident, that they were planning on showing Jaws the whole time, but the animatronic thing kind of failed in the salt water. They hadn't really prepped for that, and so they just had to film around it. And in the way that Sam Raimi copied for the Evil Cam and the Evil Dead films, and the original Alien, I think one of the most terrifying features of it is you just get like hints and glimpses of this creature that keeps seeming to look a little bit different than what you thought he looked like before, and you can't really see it all. Or maybe even say The Exorcist, where all you see is the little girl, but you don't see the demonic threat in the room. You don't see what is possessing her, and you're kind of wondering. And so this is maybe another little practical guide for writers. If you want to make something really terrifying, figure out what the most intriguing part of it is and try to hide that part. Let me hit one more invisible monster thing that I like so much. It's from one of my favorite kind of monster myth, folklore, horror films. It's a Russian one based off the novels, called Night Watch. And I think this is back in like 2003 or something like that, early 2000s. It's fascinating, and the book is great, but the movie kind of ramps it up a notch. So I think it's one of those many examples in which the movie ends up being better than the book. And in Night Watch, the film, there's a moment in which our main character is going in to arrest this vampire because he turned this young lady into a vampire without getting the proper license and without filling out the proper paperwork, which is, I'm laughing about it, but it's a very serious matter to them. If you're a monster in the former Soviet Union, that you do everything by the book. And so they end up, he ends up tracking him down into an abandoned barber shop, and he demands that this vampire come out of the gloom. He gives him orders, and the gloom is like some of the creatures can shift themselves into the netherworld or the shadow world in which they're still present, but they see things differently and you can't see them. This is the exact same kind of physics of the Nazgul and Tolkien, by the way. I've been trying really hard not to keep bringing up Tolkien. Even in The Damned Thing, you have the moment where the invisible monster is making impressions on the grass. Well, back in this, in the Silmarillion by Tolkien, the time when Isildur, who cut off the ring of Sauron, claimed it for himself, and the Gladden Fields, the disaster of the Gladden Fields, and the orcs are, things are gone bad, and the orcs are hunting him down, but he's invisible. Tolkien writes that they tracked him by scent and slot through the grass. And you're like, scent and slot through the, what's scent and slot? Oh, in the grass, they can smell him, but they can also see his path is essentially this long groove through the grass, the slot that they, and so talk about a wonderful brief way to handle sounds and words. Tolkien was so good at that. I think year after year, people are starting to realize his language mastery, and maybe stop diminishing him for kind of nonsense reasons or false accusations, and start realizing how powerful of a storyteller and poet he was. I am way off track. I knew it was going to happen. Okay, back to Nightwatch. So this vampire is in the gloom, and so he is invisible, and the guy is afraid to go into the gloom and chase him because it's dangerous to his own life. He can't stay there for very long, so he's trying to fight off this vampire who's messing with him, and he can see him in the mirrors, though. And so it's kind of this nice, every monster in Nightwatch or every type of occult kind of horrific feature of it, like reverses or plays with or brings in completely different ideas than the typical kind of American tropes on the thing. And so in this one, he can see this vampire in mirrors. And so as they're fighting and throwing each other around, and they break up glass, and he's holding this mirror right in front of his face to try to turn and turn around to see if he can catch glimpses of him, while the vampire has these like tiny little barber shears that he just keeps stabbing into him, like these tiny little puncture wounds all over him. And it's this really brutal, hardcore scene. And he ends up, when he finally kind of offs the vampire, his friends pull in at the very last minute and blast these kind of anti-vampire bulbs in the room, and he uses the mirror to like reflect the light and kill him, and the vampire is thrown back and smashes against this porcelain sink, but his own skull breaks like porcelain. It's this surreal moment where you're waiting to see the porcelain break and he breaks apart like porcelain and he's dead. God, it's visually, it's so compelling and amazing. I'm not necessarily a cinematographer, and I don't know how one would train cinematographers, but I'm guessing that anyone trying to figure out how to play with editing an image and all sorts of other visual features in films ought to watch Nightwatch and study every damn scene of that movie, because it's just so amazing. Well, so I think, I don't know, how'd that feel to you? I think we covered a lot of intriguing invisible monsters. And if you made it this far into the show, then once again, congratulations, you survived another outing with the Monster Professor. So which kind of monster are we going to talk about next time? What's coming up for future shows? You'll just have to wait and see, but I've got some interesting ones planned and some interesting interviews, interesting interviews scheduled coming up. So we've got some cool things coming up in 2019, and thank you very much for spending time with and listening to The Monster Professor.